Good evening. My name is Trevor Bowen, and tonight we're going to begin a Bible study into the book of Isaiah. Now, if you've already been watching our Bible study series that's been posted on YouTube by Stephen Russell, then you realize that we have actually studied way past this time. In fact, we've even gone to the point in time where we've seen Israel, Samaria fall, Judah, Jerusalem fall, and also the fall of the Assyrian, the Babylonian, and even the Greek empires, and gone all the way to the period of the Roman Empire and the introduction for Jesus. Now, tonight, we're going to take several steps back from that, and we're going to go back to the time of Isaiah, who prophesied to Judah, and specifically Jerusalem, while Jerusalem was obviously still standing, but even part of his career overlapped the time when Israel, when Samaria was still standing, before Assyria even came into power. We'll talk about that more in a little bit, but we're going back in time to cover the book of Isaiah. So there's a little jump in continuity with the studies that we've been going through so far. But that's valuable because Isaiah is going to prophesy about a lot of the events that we've already been studying in our history. Now, by way of introduction, I like to be able to just jump straight into a study. I like to spend as little time as possible on the introduction of a book. But oftentimes, as is the case with Isaiah, there are certain things that we need to go through, certain challenges, if you will, that make Isaiah a difficult book to understand. And so what I'd like to do is spend the bulk of this first class actually going through some of the challenges that we're going to face as we go through this study. One of the first things that we're going to deal with is just the constraints of this class itself. But the book itself also has several challenges that it presents to us. Challenges about the author and the authenticity of the book, as well as the way it's written, the language of it. It is a book that is steeped in history, and so that presents some challenges for us. And then also, just due to the size of the book and the way it's written, there will be certain challenges in identifying the key themes, as well as coming up with a cohesive outline that describes the book and helps us move forward. All right, so what challenges are we going to see as we deal with the format of the class? Well, as I already alluded, there's a lot of material to cover. There's 66 chapters, actually almost 1,300 verses. And if you think about that, and we've got 25 classes, including tonight's session, that's about 3 chapters per class, about 54 verses on average. That's a lot of material to go through in each class. And so what that implies is we're going to have to do a high-level overview. We're not going to be able to dig into detail, and when we do, it's only going to be for a few select passages. And so what that means is that you're just getting your feet wet into this class. If you've never studied it before and you're not familiar with Isaiah, then this will be a great class. You're in for a real treat. It's a wonderful book, but please understand you're just getting an introduction. There's an awful lot of study that is worthwhile, and I would encourage you to do, to dig into the book beyond this class. Now, to help do that, we have 291 questions that we're going to go through over these 25 sessions. And that works out to about 12 questions per class. And if you divide it up among the verses, that's about 4.5 verses per question. The bad news is whenever I've taught before, I only cover about 9 or 10 questions per class. That means there's actually more questions to go over, not to mention verses, than we have time to cover. So, just letting you know up front, we're going to skip over a few questions. I encourage you to please do all of them in advance. I think you'll get the most out of the class that way. But to save time, I'm going to have to skip over a few, and then some I will just present and directly answer myself as a way of moving through the material more quickly. And then before we move on, I also just make a comment about the questions themselves. I prefer to teach using thought questions. Some people think of them as difficult questions or challenge questions. Today is an exception. This will be the only class in which I will lecture for the whole time. For every class after this, it's going to be interactive, and we're going to go through the questions as our outline or our agenda for the class, And we're going to be relying upon people being prepared and answering those questions and engaging in the class. So tonight's an exception. We're going to focus on these thought questions for the remainder of the class. And I choose and prefer thought questions because I think it helps us to have a greater depth of understanding, and it makes it easier to make application. And at the end of the day, that's what we want to do. We want to better understand God's Word so that we can move closer to Him, so that we can purify ourselves to be more like Him and more pleasing to Him. And so as we go through the rest of the classes, we're going to be focusing on these questions and discussions surrounding them as we move forward. The other thing that's a challenge is that we're doing this online. This is something that's brand new for many of us. I've never hosted an online class in this format before. Maybe you've never sat through a class like this before. So this is going to be a learning experience for all of us. So ask your patience as we go through this, since we'll all be learning, and we'll probably tweak things as we figure out better ways to do things as we go through the class. All right, how about the book itself? Let's just start with the basics, the beginning. Who was Isaiah? Well, he was the first major literary prophet. And when we say major, what we mean is opposed to shorter. In other words, this has to do with the length of his book. If you compare him to some of the other prophets, their books are shorter. And so this has nothing to do with significance. This is just simply a matter of how much was written and recorded and preserved for a given author. And we say literary to contrast it with, say, Elijah or Elisha, prophets who were very critical to the history of Israel and very instrumental in key reformations, but yet they weren't prophets who wrote down their messages from God and they were preserved. They would have been oral prophets who would have preached and spoke and dealt directly with the people and not left us a written record that we know of to go back and learn from. So what does the book tell us? Well, he introduces by saying that he's the son of Amoz there in the first verse of the first chapter. According to Hebrew tradition, so this is extra Bible sources, Amoz was supposedly the brother to King Amaziah. That would make him the son of the King Joash. And that would make Isaiah, if that's true, a cousin to King Uzziah. And that's the first king that Isaiah is going to overlap and that his career is going to overlap with. So, we know from the book that his wife was a prophetess. That's not explained in any more detail, so we don't know if she had a prophecy or if she was considered a prophetess by virtue of being married to him, or the fact that their children, at least their names, had prophetic significance. So their first child was Shear Jeshub, and that means a remnant shall return. So at the beginning of the book, when this child is already born and introduced, And his name is told to us very early in the book, we understand that there's going to be a large section of Judah and Jerusalem that's going to be carried away and only a remnant's going to return. And that is sealed up in Shear Jashub's name. The second son that he has, Mayor Shalal Hashbaz, which incidentally is the longest name actually in the Bible. His name means the spoil speedeth, the prey hasteth. So he's looking forward to the fact that doom is coming very quickly, and it's going to carry away much of the treasures and the riches that Jerusalem has at that time. According to Hebrew tradition, so this is something, again, that we don't know for sure, he was actually sawed in half by Manasseh. So we don't have any recording of his career overlapping Manasseh. We only have it through the King Hezekiah. So this is something that we have just by tradition. However, the book of Hebrews does mention of people, it says, for time would fail me to tell of others who were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were tempted, slain with the sword, and so on. They were afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. And so all we can say about this is that if this applies to Isaiah, that if he did suffer in this way, that surely the blessing of Hebrews also applies to him, that the world was not worthy of such people, and he is certainly in a much better place and enjoying a much greater blessing now. All right, so the next question is, and the next challenge is who really wrote Isaiah. When he said it was Isaiah, he refers to himself at least 15 times in the book, and this was unquestioned by all scholars, Jewish and Christian scholars, all through the 19th century, or at least until the 19th century. But at that time, we have the modern critics who appeared. And what they assert is that the book of Isaiah was actually written by somewhere between 2 to 12, maybe even 15 or 20 people over hundreds of years. So it's a collection. It's an anthology that's been collected. Why do they say this? Well, their case, and I'm not someone who's read all of their articles and their works, but what I've read of commentaries who have answered that and in the process have explained what their case is, it seems to be something that's mostly subjective and built upon presupposition. Like, first of all, just the fact that somebody in the 18th and the 19th and the 20th centuries would believe that somehow they have managed to crack open and expose who was the real author of the book of Isaiah, but all the people for 2,500 years before that, none of them had a clue. There is an arrogance to that. And maybe that could be true, but such a claim would need tremendous evidence to back that up, to say that everybody that came before them was completely oblivious to the fact that there were multiple authors to the book. So what is the evidence they provide for that? Well, they say that the book's kind of disjointed. It doesn't flow together. It moves from one topic to another in kind of an awkward way that appears like it's disjointed. Well, maybe it is, and maybe these scholars just don't understand it the way it was intended to be understood. The other thing they point out is there's a slight variation in wording style. Now, it can't be too dramatic of a difference because they say that it's clearly written by somebody who was a disciple or somebody trying to imitate Isaiah. So again, nobody else was able to pick up on the fact that somebody was pretending to be Isaiah for 2,500 years, but yet they figured it out. The other thing is they say that some of his wording is too sophisticated. It's too modern. It doesn't forget in his time, or it doesn't fit into his time. And I find that very hard to accept. Who is any of us to say what was common vernacular and what was the common wording and the common expression, of people that lived 2,500 years ago? Just the statistical, amount of records that we would have of that time would just, to me, it's just incredulous. And so that's a very flimsy, a very subjective case, in my opinion. What's driving this? Well, these people also assume that miracles, inspiration, and certainly telling the future are impossible. They don't believe in anything that's miraculous. But Isaiah has a ton of fulfilled prophecies. So the only way they can work with this is to come up with this kind of story to explain it away. This seems to be a case that's not only subjective and arrogant, it's also very prejudicial. It's something that they need to believe to hold to their worldview. And they just don't have the basis, any real evidence to support that. So what evidence do we have to the contrary besides the 2,500 years of people who've always said that Isaiah was the author? Well, beyond that, Isaiah is the most quoted prophet in the New Testament, about 213 references. And even Jesus quoted from him. So, in fact, Jesus was one of the ones who quoted some of the sections of the book that are the most disputed. So we have Jesus holding up those sections and saying Isaiah wrote those. The other thing that we have is, let me back up. How do we explain then these variations in wording and these variations in style? I think those are very easy to understand that we're clearly dealing with a lifetime career for this man. And so we have a lifetime of visions. Obviously, the man has grown and developed. His vocabulary is going to change. that Jerusalem was an intersection for so many different nations, not only invading literally and violently and bringing their culture, but also metaphorically, as people's culture would come in from all of the neighboring countries and would cross-pollinate and change. And so it's that cosmopolitan society that having these influences from all these neighboring countries would easily explain variations in some of these wordings in words that seem like they belong from other cultures or other languages and not necessarily. And the other thing that I think that helps us to understand this is that this is a book that he could have compiled very late in his life. So it would have been something that he would have organized, of course, with the Holy Spirit's benefit and inspiration's benefit, and he would have been able to put it together in a system that would have made sense to the Holy Spirit and that would have made sense to him. And so I think understanding that, that this is something that developed over time but was compiled by him and had all these different influences easily explains these small variations that we see. And as far as the disjointedness, we'll talk about that a little bit more as we talk about the outline itself. All right, so let's talk about some challenges of the language. First of all, one of the things I think makes Isaiah a little bit harder to understand is he's very fond of figurative language. In fact, as far as I know, he was the first of the Bible writers to use apocalyptic language. And it's very hyperbolic. So it exaggerates a lot. And if you're not familiar with this word, apocalyptic, it's taken from the book of Revelation. And in fact, it's the Greek word for revelation. The apocalypse means to reveal or to manifest, to make manifest, to show or make known. And so that's taken from the first verse of the book of Revelation. And so it's just another way of saying that the cataclysmic, end of the world type language that we see in the book of Revelation, we'll call that apocalyptic. Isaiah is one of the first people to use that. And as a consequence of that, I think he sets up kind of the code, if you will, the key to understanding Revelation is set up by prophets like Isaiah and Daniel and Joel and Zechariah and others. Ezekiel would be another one. So this makes him a little bit harder to understand because he's using that so much. And even when he's speaking literally, he is very flowery and very picturesque in his language. He uses a lot of different words and a lot of different images to express what he's saying. And so that adds to the challenge of trying to understand Isaiah. But at the same time, it also enriches the meaning. And by pushing us to go deeper to understand, I think that helps us, it emphasizes the lessons and the truths more. I can't help but think about Jesus when he talked about the man who found the treasure in the field, or he found the pearl of great price, and it was something that was either difficult to find or was very expensive, and it cost him everything that he had to try to get that. In some ways, Isaiah is not that bad. We can understand it, I think, relatively easily. But because of these things that make it a little bit more difficult to understand, I think that makes it all the more valuable and it makes it all the more impressive and meaningful on us when we invest, when we give whatever we have to give so that we can understand it and so that we can make application to ourselves. One of the other things that Isaiah does is that he makes up nicknames. I don't know of any other writer off the top of my head that does this, but he makes up nicknames for cities and for people based on their characteristics, nicknames that we don't find anywhere else. Now, it becomes clear what he's referring to as he continues to talk about them. In fact, he'll use the common names, but that's something that is figurative and also makes them a little bit more difficult to understand and can throw you off at first. The thing that is probably one of the most challenging things to me is some of the figures that he used. This doesn't happen too often, but occasionally he'll use a figure that is not used hardly anywhere else. And so if there's a word that you only hear once and you don't ever hear it again and you don't ever hear it in any other context, it's very hard to figure out what that word means. And there's one or two figures. The one that comes to mind is the one about the Leviathan. That is very challenging, I think, to understand exactly what he's trying to say. Another thing about his language, it's obvious that he's very well educated. He has a huge vocabulary, the commentators tell us. And the people that are familiar with the original language say that there are a lot of plays on words, and he uses a lot of alliteration, so words that start with the same sound over and over and over again. And then as he's describing certain things, he deliberately starts leaving out words. He starts abbreviating sentences such that they're not grammatically correct, but maybe it maybe it conveys a sense of hurry and a sense of panic and a sense of rush. And so he uses a lot of things in the language. Unfortunately, many of them are lost in translation. But some of them, like the abbreviated sentences, they will come through in the translation process. So just be aware of that, that there is a depth here that we're completely glossing over, and we just don't have time to get into. Another thing about his language is that it's very majestic. It's very high, it's very sweeping. He deals with lofty themes. He talks about the morality, the judgment, the rise and fall of nations, of kings. So some of the most sweeping themes that we can think of in world affairs. And then he exalts Jehovah as the majestic, the holy sovereign king over these things. So his focus on God and the way he elevates God as the majestic one, again, adds to the majesty and the grandeur and the floweriness of his language. And then he also looks ahead and sees God's chosen messianic king. And as he speaks about him, about Christ, the majesty of him is obviously compelling and profound for everyone that is a Christian and that is named the name of the Messiah of Christ. As Isaiah talks, his language is also very emotional. He vividly depicts the grief and the joy of these people who are rising and falling and being destroyed. And he also shows his own emotion in this process as well. In fact, you'll find him where he says, look away. I just don't even look at me as I cry. And so despite his best efforts, you even see his own grief and his own sorrow in the book. I cannot imagine the emotions that Isaiah felt as he learned of the heartache and the destruction, as well as the hope and the comfort that was coming for God's people, both physical and spiritual. And you see that as you go through the book. All right, so what challenges do history bring to us? Well, Isaiah is a book that is covering, as we said, rise and fall of kings and nations. And so there's many historical references there, but a lot of time has passed. And there's some minor details that are very difficult to verify. One of the hardest things is there is a ton of references to cities and other nations, and these nations were wiped out. And so it's very difficult to know exactly where that city was located. So there are some things that we would like to understand in more detail that we just can't, because they're just lost to the sands of time and to history. One of the other things that makes it difficult to date and know exactly when certain events occurred and what they're referring to is that oftentimes kings reigned side by side or co-regent. So as a father was waning in years, he may get his son to begin reigning with him such that their reigns actually overlapped. Or in some cases, you might have one king who's in power and another one who revolts and begins to reign at the same time, but he's only accepted in a different part of the country. So those kinds of things make dating very complicated. The other things that are complicate the dating and understanding the history and being very precise in that is that oftentimes kings accepted multiple names, honorary titles, or abbreviated forms of their names, even maybe nicknames. And so seeing like three different references to the same person is understandably confusing, but that happened. And then we also find some contradictions in the secular records. Again, doesn't happen too often, but for example, in the records of Assyria, there's two different people who say they destroyed Samaria. So two different kings of Assyria said that they both destroyed Samaria. How do you explain that? Well, maybe they did that because they just wanted to take credit for it. One of the more likely explanations, possible explanations, is that one of them was king when the siege began against Samaria, and then one of them was maybe a general or somebody leading that siege, but he was not the king. And then before the siege was completed, the first king died, and the second king rose to power, and so he completed the destruction. And then he personally maybe he undertook it, or he oversaw it as a general or maybe as a leader. So in that way, both of them helped to overthrow Samaria and were responsible for the siege and destruction. But again, those are the kinds of things that make it complicated and difficult to date things. The other thing is that as history and archaeology uncovers more details about the events of the past, we're able to refine our dates and get closer to what we think are more accurate dates, but it's difficult to say which ones are the best dates. Despite all of this, all of these difficulties, most everybody for most of the dates are only disputing a year, give or take. There's very few events that are more than, say, maybe 10 or 15 years where there's any dispute as far as when they happened. So the history, even though there are some challenges that I'd like for you to understand, please understand that it is also extremely precise compared to maybe some of the charges that unbelievers may levy and some of the confusion and some of the doubt that they may try to instill. All right, so with that said, let's see if we can summarize Isaiah's career over the time of history. So, as we said, the first king that he would have interacted with was Uzziah. And Uzziah finished his reign about 739-741 B.C. And again, this is going to be complicated because of a co-regency. So, the first king that actually overlapped with him was his son, Jotham. And he would have reigned from 750-734 B.C. Now, it appears that Jotham's son, Ahaz, may have actually butted up against Uzziah, and when Uzziah died, Ahaz would have been a co-regent with Jotham. So Jotham or Jotham would have been the king bridging the grandfather and the grandson, so Uzziah and Ahaz. So these would have been the three kings that would have reigned during the first part of Isaiah's career. During this time, Israel, the northern kingdom with their capital of Samaria, was the biggest threat and was the biggest source of pressure and discouragement. It was the biggest threat to the people of Judah and Jerusalem at that time. At the same time, Syria, whose capital was Damascus, would have also been a threat and would have been a pressure and an invasive force to these people. And there are times that we're going to see in Isaiah when these two nations actually cooperated and tried to invade and tried to take over Jerusalem. During this time, Amos and Hosea are two prophets that actually would have been preaching to the northern kingdoms. They wouldn't have been focusing on Judah and Jerusalem. They would have been focused on the northern kingdoms. The larger empire that's overlapping this time period is Assyria. Now, Assyria is an old empire that has waned and now waxed and has grown strong again into the Neo-Assyrian Empire. And Tiglath-Pileser III, or Pul, as we know him, is going to be the king that's going to invade and be the big threat for the bulk of the first half of Isaiah. And then we go all the way from him all the way through Sennacherib. And after Sennacherib, Assyria begins to weaken in power, and eventually Babylon will come on the scene. So the last king that we read about in the book of Isaiah is Hezekiah. And the bulk of Isaiah's work overlaps with Hezekiah. And during this time, the prophet Micah will prophesy to the people of Judah and have a very similar message, although much more condensed, to Isaiah, who was preaching to the people of, it seems, of the city of Jerusalem. And the last king that we assume at some point overlapped with Isaiah is Manasseh, who, as we said earlier, according to tradition, actually martyred him or killed him by sawing him in half. All right. Now, let's talk about major themes of the book of Isaiah. I think the major theme of Isaiah is that salvation belongs to Jehovah. Salvation is of the Lord. And that is set in contrast to so many other things that the people struggled with. It's not unrestrained passion. It's not greed and materialism. It's not unmerciful, lawless injustice, oppressing the poor and oppressing the widows and taking things from them just so they can accumulate and so they can have even more. It's not all of the idols and whether from whatever nation, from wherever this influence was. But it's also not foreign governments. Assyria is not going to save them. Egypt's not going to save them. Babylon's not going to save them. And really, if all the kingdoms and peoples of the world join together. So in the book of Isaiah, we see a perspective, if everybody, if the whole world joined together, God's still going to judge them. God's going to still levy judgment against them and bring destruction on them. And it reminds me of Proverbs 16:5, which talks about how God abhors the proud, and even if they all banded together, they couldn't overthrow him, that he would still rule and prevail over them. And you have this kind of picture in Isaiah of building up all of these forces. And the other thing we see is not just evil things about men, but even good people. Even some of our heroes of faith, like Hezekiah, salvation's not in him. Even though he was able to do so many good things, he yet failed himself. And so salvation is not really going to come from any source of man, any shape, form, fashion, organization, or arrangement. You may recognize this picture from when Stephen was going through the book of Daniel, and this is from Nebuchadnezzar's dream from Daniel chapter 2. And here we have the symbol of these four different successive empires, but it's shown to us as a man, as a human. And I think there's a similar kind of picture in the book of Isaiah, that it doesn't really matter what organization of men, what agenda, how we put them together, what contract we bind them with. There is nothing we can do with men to perfect men to save us. Salvation is going to come from God and nowhere else. And I think that is the fundamental problem of Judah and Jerusalem at this time. And that's the main lesson that Isaiah is trying to communicate to them. One of the illustrations that occurred to me is this is a symbol of the Trinity that you often see. And the idea is that there's three different points here. People think it was the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. And it's difficult to say where one stops and where one ends, that they're interconnected and that they're interweaved and they're tightly coupled together. And in reality, instead of worshiping the true God, there was a Trinity. There was a triune God that Judah and Jerusalem was practically worshiping, and they were all tightly coupled. It was idolatry. But it was also their trust in the foreign nations, as well as their desire to please themselves and satisfy their own lust and their desires for greed. And these things are interconnected. Often they would turn to idolatry because it satisfied their greed. Or maybe it would please a foreign government. Or maybe they liked a foreign nation because they liked their idols. or they liked their cruelty and their materialism. These things are interconnected, and you'll see that as Isaiah moves through these themes, that he deals in, with each of these and effortlessly moves from one to the other. They are very tightly coupled and all interwoven. So some of the other themes is as we said, salvation is of the Lord because he is the Lord of hosts. So this is the most common reference to God in here. It's used 62 times. And when you see hosts, think of armies. He is the Lord of armies. He has armies at his disposal and at his command. And so, again, put this in contrast to Assyria or Egypt or Babylon, who has armies, but not like Jehovah. But he's also holy. This is not a God that is given over to cruelty and to hatred and to passion and lust. He is a holy God. He is a pure God. And he is not politically focused, compromising. He is the God of truth. And so you see, even though this is not a phrase that's used in the book, you see this ideal of God being exalted in this way because he alone is the true God and the source of truth. And God is exalted because he is the only one who can foresee the future, and he can tell it, and he can make sure that it really happens even after he said it. And that's something that idols can't do and that no other king can do. And so, in a similar vein, he will ultimately triumph over everyone, over everything, whether we're talking about idols, kings, nations, or the whole world. He's going to triumph over all of it. And the servants that he chooses, the latter half is concerned with three of them, they will succeed. They will do what he instructed them to do, or that he chose them to do. They will succeed, and nobody can stop that. So this is why salvation is going to come from him and from no one else. And also, we're going to see that God is very patient and that he will exhaust mercy, that he will hang on as long as can be hung on. But eventually judgment will come, and when it comes, only a remnant's going to be saved. It's only going to be a small part of Judah and Jerusalem that survives. This is a reoccurring theme that you see many times. And then also we see that he's the one who alone controls peace. He can provide peace, and then he can deny peace. He can take it away. He is the God of all comfort, as we're told in 2 Corinthians 1, verses 3 through 6. And the latter half of Isaiah is going to deal with that. And then he's going to be the one who's going to establish his messianic king and the messianic kingdom, and it's going to bring in not only the Jew, but it's going to bring in the Gentile as well. So, again, this is why salvation is of the Lord. He's the only one who can, and he's the only one who will do this. So, summing this up, I think the application that we see over and over again, even if it's not directly stated, is to turn to the Lord, trust in him, wait on him, take joy and comfort in him, find your hope in him, and despite all the distresses and all the challenges that are going to happen to God's people, you can overcome if you do trust in him, if you do lean on him, and if you do find your hope and your joy in him. These are the major themes, I think, of Isaiah and of the book. All right, so now I want to talk about some challenges in putting together an outline and in understanding the book. Before we do that, I want to take a step back and actually think about the book of Judges. If you remember from the book of Judges, there was a cycle of sin and of salvation. You would have apostasy, so the people would apostatize, they would fall away, and then God would afflict them. He would punish them by sending in some army or some foreign nation to oppress them. The people would suffer, and then they would repent, they would cry out to God, and then he would bring a deliverer, somebody that would push back the foreign nation, and then it would bring in a time of peace. And this is something that during the period of Judges, it would happen at different regions within the country. It may have not, these periods, this cycle may have not been synchronized over the entire nation all at once. So, in other words, you might have a part of the nation that would be in a peace period while another part of the nation might be suffering affliction, and another one might be in between and just starting to apostatize or something like that. So this cycle, it can represent regional, but you can also kind of average it out or expand it out for an entire nation and say that this happens to a nation as a whole, as you think about it as an aggregate where we have highs and lows. And what I want you to think about, what happens as this cycle happens over and over and over again in a nation? What we see, at least in the history of Israel, is that those lows get lower and lower and lower and lower, and the highs become less frequent. They become further apart, and the lows begin to dominate. So the reason why I want you to bring this to mind is Isaiah is at a unique vantage point. He has a unique perspective in that he is going to see a very big, a very rich picture that's going to go across time, and he's going to see that cycle happen multiple times. And so you will see the theme of condemnation, that the people are guilty, they're increasing their guilt, they're increasing the sin, and he condemns them. And as a result of that, he's going to issue warning. God has judged them, and he's going to punish them through increasing invasion and destruction from various sources. But he's also, again, thinking about our cycle, he's going to have a message of hope. There will be a deliverer. There will be a remnant that's going to be saved. And the obvious implication is you want to repent. You want to be part of that remnant. And then also associated with that is the destroyers, the instruments of punishment, are themselves going to be punished. God is going to avenge his people on them, and he's going to take those nations out of the way. So this is the one that's going to be the Savior who brings justice for God's people. That's something that you see over and over again. And then you see periods of peace that are being promised, that are being held out to help bring hope and comfort to God's people, promising future blessing and victory. And so you're going to see this cycle throughout the book of Isaiah as he applies that to several different cases. So if you think of this as a big picture, that Isaiah is looking across a vast distance of time, in the immediate foreground of his vision is Israel and Syria. So Samaria and Damascus, who are trying to take over Jerusalem. But they are quickly taken out of the way in the first few chapters. And then we have, for the longest period of the book, we have the threat of Assyria. So a global world empire that is the first big threat that has come upon Jerusalem. And then, beyond them, we're going to have the threat of Babylon. So another nation that is going to threaten to invade, but that's further away into the distance. That's further away in time. And then beyond even that, we have the Messianic Kingdom. So we have the Messianic Kingdom set up against the world empire, or the world city, as others will refer to it, as a clash between all the empires in the world against the Messianic Kingdom. So Isaiah has a very deep and complex image in his mind that he is showing to us and helping us to understand. So this presents some challenges in outlining, because there's a lot of overlap. When he's talking about condemnation or hope, is he applying it to the time of Israel and Syria, or is he applying it to Babylon, or is he applying it to Messianic Kingdom? And what's even worse is they're actually interspersed. You can't say that, well, the first part of the book is strictly on this specific threat. Where actually we find Babylon, for example, in Messianic Kingdom being dealt with very early in the book, even though they're much more frequent as the book goes on. So there's a lot of overlap, and so that presents some challenges in trying to understand in a given context exactly what he's applying these themes and these principles to. All right, so one way I like to think about this is actually just visually, a picture. This is the background that we're using for all the slides. As you look at this picture, what do you see? There's a mountain on the right that's in the immediate foreground. You can even see some of the bushes. There's another mountain on the far left that's a little bit further away. And there's another mountain chain that's further away behind that. And then finally you have the clouds. You have the sun even beyond that. Depending on where you're looking, you may see slightly different things. There's different focal points. It's a very deep and rich picture. One other illustration that I'll provide very quickly is, and I kept looking for a picture that really contained this, but if you look at this picture, there's obviously a waterfall that's in the front of this. This is right in your face. It is the most dominant thing. But if you look past that, you'll see this river and the forest. And if you look carefully, in the middle on the right, you'll see it looks like a little village. And if you look behind that, you'll see that there's a storm clouds hanging over the village in what looks like a fort, like a tower that stands up on a hill. Maybe it's looking out for an invasion force. And then behind that, there's more mountains. So I use this as an illustration. I think we've all seen pictures like this where there's many different focal points in a picture. And depending on exactly where you're looking, you can see what is in and of itself a picture in its own right. You can take Isaiah, and he could have easily been multiple different books. Any of these themes could have made a book in their own right. But he's taken and he's woven all of these together so that we have a very rich book, but yet, again, a very challenging book to try to understand as we try to determine exactly what he's focusing on in any given verse or context. So one last illustration about outlining and the challenges of it. I don't know about you, but I like very simple outlines where we start with the simplest foundational topics, and then we build to the next topic, and we build to the next. So we have a stair step, if you will. I like simple outlines. A lot of the New Testament is certainly this way. Romans, Hebrews, many of Paul's writings are set up this way, and I think it's the way that's easiest to absorb. It's the simplest outline. Unfortunately, Isaiah is not outlined this way. It's more like the interwoven threads of a rope. So you can think about all of these different themes that we've talked about, and this cycle that's being applied over and over again, and Isaiah is going to move between these themes as we move between chapters. And it can be disorienting, but you have to understand that we have all these things that are woven together, and the outline is moving between these as we go through. So you'll see some repetition as he moves back and forth between themes and between topics. So why would the Holy Spirit do this? Why would Isaiah be written in this way? I think there's some possible benefits. If you find it frustrating, I think there are some benefits to this interweaving. First of all, it makes it easier to reject any multiple author theory. So, and if you think about it, the idea that multiple people could have coordinated and worked this together, it becomes a lot harder to say, well, this part was written by this person and this part was written by somebody else, when the same people are touching on all the topics and dealing with them in a uniform way. It makes it a lot harder to take it apart when everything's interwoven together like that. The other thing is I think this may be a more effective way of reaching people who are entrenched in their sin, or maybe they're just impatient and they're hard-hearted and they're not listening and they're rebellious. So if somebody's entrenched in their sin, you often just can't talk for a long period of time like we've done tonight and cover some point in detail. You've got to take apart a little bit, let them absorb it, let them raise their question, and then deal with the next thing that's their next hang-up. And then you move on to the next thing, and then you cycle back around eventually, and you can take apart a little bit more. But deconstructing false concepts, error in the minds of people that are entrenched in it, it's very difficult. And doing it, recognizing that it's interwoven in people's mind, if we take an interwoven approach, Maybe that's more effective. And it seems like Isaiah is doing that. Or if somebody is just not willing to listen for an extended period of time, there's no reason to do an extended elaboration on any point. You can just touch on each of the different points and then come back to them as they might be more open to it again. Another thing is he has some very difficult points and applications, things that would invoke terror. And that terror is often offset and balanced, if you will, with hope, with comfort. It's, even though it's really bad and you need to react to it and judgment is coming, there is a silver lining. And so I think that may be the other reason for the alternation that we see. Another thing is once this is entrenched in somebody's mind, once somebody has a grasp of it, then like a rope, it's harder to take apart in their mind now. They have a firm grasp of it. So, whatever the benefits, whatever the reason, the rationale was for the outline as we have it, we have to trust the Lord and know that He knows best and accept the outline that's been given to us. And then just commit ourselves to learning it. So, that being said, can we do a high level, very high overview outline of Isaiah? And I think most commentators will have an outline that's something like this. You can divide it pretty easily into two halves. Chapters 1 through 39, just like the number of books in the Old Testament, make up the first half. And the primary focus is on judgment. Judgment on everybody. Begins in chapters 1 through 6 with Judah and Jerusalem specifically, and then it kind of, in chapters 7 through 12, we kind of broaden the circle to include not only Judah, but those that are invading her. And then we broaden the circle even more to talk about the heathen nations, not just Israel or Syria that are threats, but also many more nations that are idolatrous. And so we see judgment on all of those. And then chapters 28 through 35, again, we return to a set of woes focused on Jerusalem and dealing with that. Some people see the book of Isaiah as a collection of books. This one's called the Book of Woes in most people's outline. And then the last section in this first half is the only narrative that we find in the book of Isaiah. And it serves as a capstone because it shows the end of Assyria, the fall of Assyria, practically. They begin to decline severely after that. And then what we see is Assyria going out and then Babylon coming in as the new threat. So it serves as a transition for what the people of Jerusalem were going to be undergoing. Assyria was going away and Babylon was coming in. So the narrative provides that transition, but it also shows the fulfillment of everything that Isaiah had been saying up to that point about Assyria and the destruction of the nations that Assyria was bringing. So it also serves as a capstone for the first half of the book as well. The last half of the book is much more messianic, and it focuses on the salvation of Zion. And so this is the spiritual remnant, the true spiritual people of God. Chapters 40 through 48 focus on God's superiority over the idols, and this is primarily seen in His ability to foretell the future, when the idols cannot even speak, much less foretell the future. And this would have been very important for the people who would have been suffering in Babylonian captivity or after the decimation from invading forces, especially as their country was beaten by other countries. They might question, well, are their gods greater than our gods? And so this stands as an answer, no, that God is supreme, is an answer to that question. And then chapters 49 through 57 focus on, I couldn't help but think of Jesus' words that are recorded in Luke 19:42 about the people who did not know and did not recognize that their special day and the things that made for peace. And so this section is going to deal with the things that make for peace, the God of peace, and the reason why He's going to deny peace to certain people and how He's going to bring peace to other people. but a big focus on peace for there. And in the last chapters, 58 through 66, we're going to focus on the establishment of Zion, looking forward to the Messianic kingdom most strongly in this closing section. All right, so that's just a very high-level outline of Isaiah. Some of the challenges I talked about, we'll see as we get into more detail into chapters and verses of the book itself, trying to figure out exactly what it refers to and what it applies to. All right, we're just about done. All I wanted to mention tonight, just in closing, is that there were several commentaries that I had or that were loaned to me that I used in preparation for this. And I just wanted to say a word or two about these. Homer Haley's book, I think, is very helpful, and I think is probably my favorite commentary on this. I think he has probably the best grasp, in my opinion, of the book. Young's commentary is very powerful. It's much more scholarly, much more in depth, and it's actually a 3-volume set. And so if there's a particular symbol or if there's a particular verse, some word that you're trying to understand in more detail, he's excellent for that. However, he is also premillennialist. Well, I should take that back. I don't know that he's premillennialist, but he does believe that a lot of Isaiah applies to the end of the world, which I think is absolutely false. And so there are some things that some views he takes and some explanations he provides that are just not helpful. John Humphrey's commentary from the Truth Commentary set is also pretty good as well. He pulls together from a lot of these different sources, from Haley as well as Young. And then another commentary, Delitzsch, out of the Kyle and Delitzsch series, I think is also pretty good. But again, very scholarly, helpful for understanding a few words, and something about the language and very details, but at this high level, not as helpful and more difficult to read as well. There's also some good lesson books. Robert Harkrider's is very good. Even though it's not a lesson book, the Florida College 2006 lectures, Portraits in Isaiah, was also very helpful. And of course, Bob and Sandra Waldron's book, Till There Was No Remedy. And then Donnie Rader has a good workbook as well that has provides some good questions. So if you're looking for additional sources to help you better understand Isaiah or to help you deal with the questions that we have in class, I think all of these are good sources if you would like to add these to your library. All right, so that concludes what we wanted to talk about tonight. I will just close by saying, first of all, thank you for patiently listening to this introduction. I know it was long and it was tedious, but as I said at the beginning, I think these are things that get in the way and would block a good understanding of Isaiah. And so focusing on these and dealing with these at the beginning, I think will help us to have a much better understanding of Isaiah as we go through the class. The other thing that I'll mention is, as I said earlier, this will be the last of the classes that are lecture-based. All of the other classes that we have after this, whether they're online or whether they're eventually in person back at the building, they're all going to be interactive with us walking through the questions and providing opportunity to people in the audience to be able to answer those questions and to be able to have discussion and look through those. So we're going to use that to guide our way through the class. So please look for the web links for next time and for the invitation so that you can sign up and so that you can join and be a part of that class. And then please make sure that you've got your material. If you haven't already picked it up at the building, we'll provide links in the comment section of this video so you can download the questions and so that you can prepare them and so that you can be properly engaged and maximize the amount of understanding and application and the benefit that we can get from this class as we go through the other classes that follow after this. So with that, again, I'll just say thank you and I hope you have a good night. And pray God's blessings upon you, especially during this very difficult time. And if you have any questions about any of the material, any of the questions, about the questions themselves, please email me or contact me. I don't think you'll have any trouble finding me. Thank you and good night.